We have with us live in the studios once again, Jeff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
All right. A slightly, not quite as busy as last week.
That's a very relative thing in the era of Trump and
Durkin. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, nationally, it's still just as the fires.
It's a fire hose. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like things ratcheted down a tiny bit and down with people going on vacation and, you know.
Yeah. And we do have a primary election coming up. We went over our recommendations or for who we would vote for at the time last week. And we'll probably go over that quickly again next week as ballots get mailed this coming week. But, if you want to check that out, go to the archive and listen to last week's show. We went through it in great detail.
Yeah, that archive is at www.kodxseattle.org. Click on the Earth on the Air, or I'm sorry, click on the
local shows.
Yeah, on the local shows, and then you'll find Eat the Airwaves there. And once you're at the Eat the Airwaves page, you'll see over on the right a listing of the previous week's shows by date.
And there's a
Patreon button there too, which we would encourage people to use
on our main website.
Yeah,
yes,
we could definitely use more Patreon members.
Yes, we could.
Regular monthly subscribers. So, and we got the audio issues taken care of. So that was a big relief.
So the archive should be available now.
Yeah, good, good.
So, no more wrestling with people at the door.
Yes, use often and. Tip us on the way out.
Yeah, and tell your friends.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. So, starting out with development regarding the police department and their contract.
Yeah, the city of Seattle filed a request for a one-month delay in presenting a plan to Judge James Robart on how the city plans to fix problems with the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. Back in May, Judge Robart rejected that portion of the contract that covers the disciplinary process for police officers who use excessive force. He ordered the city to work with the Community Police Commission, which is a civilian body set up under the police reform process, and the Department of Justice to come up with a plan and present it to him by July 15th, and that is this coming Monday. Instead of doing that, Mayor Durkin has hired a group of consultants, all of whom are either former police or their union rep
police chiefs.
Yeah. To do the work for her. But because these consultants are brand new, it's taken them a while to get up to speed on the last 4 to 5 years of police reform work here in the city of Seattle and to sit down and start meeting with folks.
And none of those are the Department of Justice or the CPC.
Right. And that led to a group of 20 community organizations sent a letter to Mayor Durkin last month and the city council urging the mayor and other city reps to start working with the CPC already. Come on, at least schedule a meeting date, right? The CPC issued its own statement this week that includes the following, and this is a direct quote from their statement. Quote, 5 days before the deadline, the city has not yet held any meetings with any of the stakeholders mentioned by the judge, end quote. That was the statement that the CPC issued this week, along with a lot of other information in that statement, too. But the statement goes on to mention that the mayor hired the consultants without asking for the CPC's feedback, and that the Community Police Commission and community groups have been working on the issue of police reform in Seattle for years, and that they don't see what a group of new outside consultants can contribute at this point, other than more delay, of course. Notably, Durkin and other city reps have also not met with the Seattle Police Officers Guild representatives to discuss reopening the negotiations on the disciplinary portion of the contract. And that's something that they should be getting underway as soon as possible. And really, that's the only way that they're going to be able to satisfy Robart's objections to that portion of the contract is if they sit down with the Seattle Police Officers Guild and say, okay, we need to rework this portion of the contract. But there are specific issues with timing on that. The contract specifies that, you know, there be a period of time before they announce that they're reopening the negotiations. Between that and when they actually do sit down at the table, there's a period of time that's required for community members and other stakeholders to make comments to the city about that portion of the contract. So, you know, time's a wastin' here.
Yeah, and we were talking before we went on the air about media literacy. The Seattle Times article on this mentioned at the end, it's not clear whether Durkin will involve the police union in these negotiations. Of course, she has to.
She has to.
And it didn't mention at all the CPC or the other stakeholders mentioned by the judge.
Yeah.
Which is sort of the Times spin on things.
Yeah. Now, instead of meeting with the Seattle Police Officers Guild and their representatives, Durkin's strategy really appears to be, bring in an outside bunch of police consultants who will testify to the judge that Seattle's contract is as good as or maybe better than the partial reforms that these consultants have worked on in other city police office, other city police departments. And then in that way, she's going to try to win agreement from the Department of Justice, I think, and eventually maybe the CPC if she can, in order to sway the judge. But I just don't think that's going to work. But, Durkin is, her background is as a public prosecutor, and she was the U.S. attorney for the Western District of Washington. So she's used to working with police, seeing things from their perspective, and she's not seeing it from the perspective of the community and folks objecting and the judge and other folks who are objecting to the fact that this disciplinary portion of the contract does not meet city law.
Well, she has enough of a legal background that she should understand.
She should.
That
yeah.
This is a legal proceeding. And in the legal proceeding, the reform processes of other cities are completely, absolutely irrelevant.
Yes.
It's strictly a question of whether the judge believes that this contract comports with the reform process that the DOJ has laid out for the city of Seattle.
And that the city itself passed a police reform bill in 2017, and the disciplinary portion of this contract does not adhere to that new law that
no,
the city passed.
It rolls back a number of provisions.
And that the mayor signed. So, yeah. She needs to get with that and start and roll up her sleeves and start working on this instead of, just kicking the ball down the street and saying, okay, we're just going to try to wear the judge down until he agrees with us.
And I would think because of that reform package that was passed, that city council would be a stakeholder in this also and would have something to say about it.
Yeah.
They've been pretty quiet so far.
Yeah, well, Lorena Gonzalez is the chair of the committee that oversees the police department and public safety. And she has been, I should say, she's been sort of a yes person, sort of a nod her head and take her cues from the police department reps rather than actually openly question what's going on, except when it comes to people of color and use of force against people of color. She will sometimes speak up, but I don't think that she really has good follow through.
No, and you would think that that would be relevant to the disciplinary process issues that
oh,
are
yes.
at stake here.
Mm-hmm.
But why is it in a almost any issue we're talking about, why is it always part of the playbook to create a group, bring in a group of outsiders and have your blue ribbon panel or whatever you want to label it as, is always like one of the solutions that they reach for first?
Because it costs money that doesn't come out of the pockets of the people doing this, and because it delays the process.
Yeah, it puts off the need to make a decision.
And because bringing in new people enables whoever is bringing in the new people, in this case, the mayor,
mm-hmm.
to be able to frame the issues that those people are considering because they don't have a background in the issues. So they're reliant on the mayor and the mayor's office to frame the issues for them. That gives Durkin more control over the process.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move on.
All right. Well, it looks like one of the candidates got some coverage in the Times this week.
Yeah, the Seattle Times this week reported that City Council candidate Brendan Colding, who's running against Lisa Herbold in District 1, was the subject of an internal investigation when he worked for the Seattle Police Department.
And this is not ancient history either.
No, it just this is very recent history. Colding apparently lied about his mistreatment of another officer and recommended that that officer lose his job. But before the internal investigation of this situation was over, Colding resigned in March of this year.
Yes.
And left the Seattle Police Department to run for the city council instead.
Yes, and suddenly realized he needed a new job.
Yeah.
And decided city council would be a perfect place to land.
Yeah. Instead of admitting that he had harassed another officer, Colding is now saying that he himself was harassed by higher-ups in the department. Colding has based much of his campaign for city council on showing support for police officers and rolling back the police reform process. But back in May, 2 months after Colding quit his job, the Office of Police Accountability found that he had broken department rules regarding professional conduct and retaliation against another officer, and that he had lied about it. It's Seattle Police Department policy that officers be fired for dishonesty, although that rule is not always followed. Colding has one more interview set up with Police Chief Carmen Best on July 25th, about 10 days from now, 11 days from now, to try and clear his name, after which Best will decide whether to uphold or overturn the OPA's ruling. So that is the news about Brendan Colding.
Yeah, and when Colding resigned, he was a lieutenant. So clearly he'd been in the department and worked his way through the ranks for some period of time. You don't resign that easily. You resign that if you don't think that the disciplinary process is going to work out in your favor and you want to head that off.
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect that he resigned rather than follow through with the disciplinary process and be terminated.
That also makes his city council candidacy look like a grudge. Like he's acting on a grudge against the city for bringing in a new disciplinary process at the Seattle Police Department.
Yeah, Lisa Herbold looks like the much better choice in that race.
Oh, yeah. And then other election news, there were several organizations that released their endorsements over the last week and a half. The union-backed Civic Alliance for a Progressive Economy, which goes by the acronym CAPE, has released its endorsements. CAPE is made up primarily of Working Washington. They're affiliated mostly with the SEIU. One America Votes, which is the voting rights project of the immigrant advocacy organization One America, and Civic Action, which is Nick Hanauer's group. They've endorsed, this is their list, District 1, Lisa Herbold; District 2, Tammy Morales; District 3, Shama Sawant; District 4, Emily Myers; District 5, Deborah Juarez; District 6, Dan Strauss and Jay Fothy, but not Heidi Wills; and District 7, Andrew Lewis.
I'm surprised by Myers, and I'm surprised by Deborah Juarez. Although Juarez really doesn't have a credible challenger that I can see.
Well, John Lombard has raised as much or more money than she has.
Lombard, I forgot about Lombard.
I'm not surprised by Deborah Juarez because, these are unions here. And the building trades unions in particular really love Deborah Juarez because she's been behind funding the really big sort of infrastructure projects the city has undertaken, like the redesign of the downtown waterfront and rebuilding the downtown waterfront park and, renovating Key Arena and then the renovations at Northgate Mall in order to put in an ice rink for an NHL team. So she's been behind those big projects that the building trades unions just love. District 7, why are you surprised by Andrew Lewis?
I didn't say Andrew Lewis. I said Myers.
Myers, Emily Myers. I'm not surprised by that either. Emily Myers is mostly, her background is labor work.
Okay.
Yeah, she was the, she was one of the main organizers behind the strike at the UW. She's been a leading organizer in the Graduate Students Union there. And she made sure that most of the folks in her department actually turned out on the picket lines when they went out on strike.
Given that UW is the 900-pound gorilla in that district, that recommends her.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I think in District 4, I've liked both Sean Scott and Emily Myers for their candidacies. They're kind of coming a little bit from different angles. Sean Scott more from the socialist perspective and definitely income inequality and sticking up for renters. Emily Myers more from a labor background.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully they won't split too many votes.
Yeah, we'll see. On the other end of the spectrum, there were two other organizations that released their... Oh, no, I should also say the King County Labor Council has released a bunch of their endorsements, although they're not done. For District 1, they've endorsed Lisa Herbold. For District 3, Zachary DeWolf. For District 4, Emily Myers. For District 5, Deborah Juarez. And for Districts 2 and 6, they have not released any endorsements yet. For District 7, they've endorsed Andrew Lewis. Again, King County Labor Council, this is labor folks. So,
and it's heavily dominated these days by the trades.
So, oh, yes.
So they are more pro-developer than you would expect.
Yeah, so that's why.
Which is partially why they
came out for Deborah Juarez.
And DeWolf in three. And they got quite a bit of blowback for endorsing DeWolf over Sawant.
Yeah. On the other end of the spectrum are two organizations, more conservative organizations. One is the Washington Technology Industry Association. And that's the main business association for the tech industry in Washington State. It includes, some of their members include companies like Amazon, Google, AT&T, Expedia, Comcast, Bank of America, and on and on and on. They just have hundreds of businesses that are members. This is the first time that they've endorsed candidates in any city of Seattle election. So that's pretty significant in and of itself and shows you just how much money is going to be pouring into these elections pretty soon.
Yeah, especially in the general election coming up in November.
And some of those companies have also contributed to CASE.
To the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. So it's no surprise that the Washington Tech Industry Association endorsed all of the same candidates as the Seattle Chamber of Commerce did. Exactly the same. District 1, Phil Tavel.
I'm shocked.
District 2, Mark Solomon. District 3, Egan O'Ryan. District 4, Alex Peterson. District 5, Deborah Juarez. District 6, both Heidi Wills and Jay Fathy. And District 7, Michael George. And the only exception there is that they didn't endorse Jim Pugel, didn't quite make their cut.
It sounds a lot like the Seattle Times endorsements, too. Just
oh,
saying.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And then the other organization, the other conservative organization, is the Rich People for Seattle, which goes by the shortened name People for Seattle. That's the group that was started by former mayor and city council member Tim Burgess and businesswoman Taylor Hong. They've endorsed a group that is absolutely identical to the candidates endorsed by the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, with the exception of two additional endorsements in District 7. They also endorsed Andrew Lewis and Jason Williams.
You know, I was almost thinking that was going to be a parody, like, you know, Billionaires for Seattle or something.
Yeah, no.
No, they have yet to release their endorsements.
Okay.
Yeah, those folks have yet to release their endorsements.
And we could start that organization right here.
They won't make their endorsements public. Let's just
right.
say that.
yes, they will. But you'll have to look at the donation list.
Yeah. So the question arises, you know, why are these groups even doing separate endorsements if they're all going to endorse the same people? And the answer simply is money. They're all collecting funds to disperse. And to collect those funds, they have to have a roster of candidates, and they have to let their rich and upper middle class donors know who it is that they're actually supporting. So that's why they're announcing endorsements and why the endorsements look almost exactly the same as the Seattle Chamber of Commerce
and
endorsements.
It also enables the candidates to list separate endorsements.
Oh, yes.
And make it look like they have more grassroots support than they actually do.
And they're going to, you know, somebody. Like Egan O'Ryan, for example, is going to say, I'm supported by the Washington Technology Industry Association. Hello, Amazon employees, give me all your money. And he's going to say, People for Seattle also endorse me. Therefore, I have grassroots backing, with, you know, leaving the rich word off there. Because as we now know, the People for Seattle is really Rich People for Seattle.
All right. Well, sticking with the elections, the democracy vouchers.
The Washington State Supreme Court ruled this week unanimously that the democracy voucher program that was passed by voters in, I believe, 2015 and has been implemented since then. But it's also been the subject of a court challenge by a handful of Seattleites claiming that it violated essentially their free speech rights. And that went all the way to the state Supreme Court. And the state Supreme Court unanimously ruled against that lawsuit this week, and that the democracy voucher program, which was the first of its kind in the country, was in fact constitutional the way it is constructed. That really is a sort of final victory for Cleve Stockmeyer, the late lawyer who died unexpectedly a couple of years ago, but whose last two projects were the democracy vouchers and the district elections in Seattle. He foresaw the flow of extreme wealth into Seattle and Seattle elections, and was trying to craft reforms that would help level the playing field, both for candidates and for voters. And That was the final victory that the state Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Democracy Voucher Program.
Yeah.
And this is the first election cycle in which that program is being used by all city council
members. All city council members, yeah. In fact, the lead justice, Steve Gonzalez, wrote for the Supreme Court, the Democracy Voucher Program does not alter, abridge, restrict, censor, or burden speech, which I think is a very important thing to lay out, because the Democracy Voucher Program is a form of public financing for elections. And public financing for elections presumes that you're going to collect revenue in some form from the public.
From taxpayers. Yeah,
from taxpayers. And so having this rule on the books saying, you know, collecting tax revenue from the taxpayers and then using a portion of it for public financing of campaigns is perfectly within the U.S. Constitution. Now, the opponents of democracy vouchers, because they're arguing about on First Amendment grounds, still have the ability to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court if they wish. But my guess is because both the King County Superior Court judge and the state Supreme Court have ruled against them, that the U.S. Supreme Court is unlikely to take it up. They have a tendency to take up cases where lower courts have issued conflicting rulings rather than taking up a case just to reaffirm what the lower courts have said. So this may be the end of the line for the opposition lawsuit against the democracy vouchers, and it's a very good thing. I also want to point out, too, that the democracy voucher program was first used in 2017 for three races, the two at-large city council races and the city attorney's office. And the winners of those races for districts 8 and 9 on the city council, Teresa Mosqueda won with 65% of her contributions as democracy vouchers, and Lorena Gonzalez won district 9 with 72% of her contributions in the form of democracy vouchers, while Pete Holmes won re-election to the city attorney's office with 66% of his contributions in democracy vouchers. So there's an argument to be made there that by allowing the public to participate in the financing of these campaigns, you get a different type of candidate in office, and you get you see that the candidates who go out and ring doorbells and shake hands and ask for democracy vouchers are the ones that are going to probably, and you know, I think in this case, most likely make it through to the final and win their elections. So that's something to keep in mind as we look at these current races this year.
It certainly creates a different path that candidates can use to raise money successfully and be competitive in races.
Mm-hmm. But you can't forget that votes are what count. The money is not what counts. It's votes that count.
Yes.
And so when we see candidates that win and they have so much of their financing as democracy vouchers, that's a reminder to us that it's the votes that count, although the money really helps.
The money really helps, because Seattle at this point is large enough, even with the districts and council races, that you cannot knock on every door.
Yeah.
Particularly because, you know, as the percentage of renters increases, the percentage of doors that are accessible and not, you know, behind locked buildings is increasing as well. It's harder to doorbell, frankly. And, you know, you have to raise money in order to buy media to reach those voters, because, or direct mail or whatever, because that's, in many cases, the only way voters will find out about these candidates.
Yeah, and the way candidates in the past have done it is they've sat down at these big luncheons with the rich people of Seattle, paying, you know, $200-$300 per plate for dinners to just kind of hear the candidate talk about their positions, you know, or to have the opportunity to shake hands with the candidate and influence them in some way, or just at least have an introduction so that when they need a little bit of help on a project, they can just knock on the door, say, hey, remember me, I contributed to your campaign. That's how it's worked in the past. With democracy vouchers, it's very different.
Yes, and going forward, it's going to be a critical counterweight to the ability of Amazon to just write a huge check, because we're starting to see enormous amounts of corporate money coming into these local campaigns. And, you know, if you're not going to be receiving that check from Amazon, you've got to have a different path to be competitive against the candidates who do. And that's what democracy vouchers represent.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, too, this in this election we're seeing these big corporations form new PACs so that they can funnel money into advertising and mailings and phone calls and so forth and text messages for their favored candidates. It'll be interesting to see if folks who are for election reform come up with an initiative or some kind of a law to try to get passed in the city of Seattle to limit the influence of PAC money locally. Yeah. That would be the next logical step, I think.
And we're also starting to see progressives trying to form their own PAC.
Yeah.
They can't compete with the level
no,
of money of Amazon.
So.
But going forward, once they're more established, they could raise a significant amount of money on their own and
yeah.
be able to bundle that to campaigns. The way you know big corporations are doing locally.
Yeah, but like I say, I think a more reasonable step might be to pass a law or a city ordinance or an initiative to the voters to limit the influence of PAC money in Seattle elections.
Yeah, I think that's going to be difficult as long as Citizens United is on the books.
Yeah, that might be difficult.
But yeah, it's mm-hmm. it's certainly worth trying.
Yeah.
All right. Before we move on to national, did you want to touch on...
I do want to talk about Restaurants Unlimited.
Okay.
This week there was an article in the Seattle Times about Restaurants Unlimited, and the title of the article was Upscale Seattle Restaurant Chain Seeks Bankruptcy Protection and Sale, Blaming Wage Hikes. The owners of Restaurants Unlimited, Sun Capital... said that they that Restaurants Unlimited had to go through bankruptcy because they couldn't afford to pay their employees the $15 an hour minimum wage. And that's BS. That's absolute BS. The problem here that was not covered in the local media is that Restaurants Unlimited had been purchased by a company called Sun Capital Partners. And Sun Capital Partners is well known as a vulture capital firm. And when I say vulture capital, it describes the way some venture capital firms operate. What they do is they buy companies that are doing okay or maybe not so good, and they say, we're going to turn this company around, right?
And then they strip them of their assets.
Well, what they do first is they take out a huge loan to buy the company, and then they put that loan on the company's books. So in other words, they make the company that they're buying finance their own purchase. So and then that company has to pay cash back to the owners, Sun Capital Partners, and they make all their money back on the loan right off the bat. And then they start stripping it of assets, making the company Restaurants Unlimited pay big dividends to Sun Capital, et cetera. They strip it of all its cash. They strip it of a lot of its assets, and they drive it into bankruptcy.
And in industries like restaurants, grocery stores, et cetera, that have notoriously thin margins of profit, that's a particularly lethal model.
Yeah, and Sun Capital has done this before. They are well known for doing this. And in fact, their own investors have sued them for taking investments that the investors thought they would turn around and turn into profitable companies, instead stripping those companies and driving them into bankruptcy. So that's really what was behind this. And Sun Capital, in order to avoid those kinds of lawsuits from their own investors, they tend to come up with these bogus reasons for why the companies are going through bankruptcy. In this case, it was just really easy for them to say that it was Seattle's $15 an hour wage hike that was the reason. But as Danny Westneat pointed out in the Seattle Times later in the week, that in fact, hundreds of restaurants have opened just this year in the city of Seattle.
Yeah, there's no shortage of restaurants in Seattle.
Yeah, and restaurants can easily do well at paying the city's minimum wage. That's not the issue. The issue is poor management, and in this case, vulture management, the kind that just sucks blood out of a company and then just kind of sells off the scraps and is happy with that.
And it's a very familiar model in Trump's America, where rich people plunder and then blame people on the very bottom for the problems that result.
Yes, the reason you're out of a job is because you were asking for too much.
Yes,
a livable wage. I mean, it is.
How dare you?
It is. Really disgusting, but that is the actual truth behind the bankruptcy of Restaurants Unlimited.
Yes, another media literacy lesson for the Seattle Times.
Yeah,
what they don't tell you.
All right, On to national then?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, appears there was a change in the bench at the Labor Department.
Yeah. Alexander Acosta resigned this week as Labor Secretary because over a decade ago, he cut a deal with the attorneys for the high-powered financier Jeffrey Epstein to not charge Epstein with federal sex trafficking, prostitution, and child pornography crimes.
This while Acosta was the U.S. Attorney appointed by George W. Bush
for the Southern
Florida.
District of Florida, yeah. And instead, he cut a secret deal that he
without
signed.
Without notifying any of the victims.
Yeah, that he signed, that Acosta signed with Epstein, allowing Epstein to be sentenced under Florida state law to just 18 months jail time, which actually was reduced to 13 months of jail time.
With work release during the day.
Yeah, with work release. And his work release was 6 days a week. So he only spent like 1 day a week in jail and some nights. So that was his punishment.
And after the 13 months,
he returned as young as 13 years old.
And trafficking them across state lines as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
And, you know, he returned to his lavish lifestyle as soon as the 13 months were over. And, you know, lots of rich friends and no apparent, you know, stigma for being a sex trafficker and a pedophile. The Southern District of New York returned sex trafficking charges against him this past Monday. And that's what set off the renewed interest in the deal that Acosta cut over a decade ago.
Yeah. Now, the prosecutors in that Florida state case, and that includes Secretary Acosta, decided not to tell the victims the terms of the deal that they had struck with Epstein. They actively worked to keep that a complete secret from the victims, which is against federal law.
Yes, it is. And that's already been educated by a federal judge.
Yeah, they actively lied to them. And that suit has been ongoing, still ongoing in court. The lawyers for the victims had to file suit in order to get the prosecutors and to tell them that Acosta had dropped the federal case against Epstein because he never told the victims.
And notably, when Acosta held a press conference on Wednesday, he blamed state prosecutors and tried to cast himself as the hero for stepping in to rescue some kind of a judgment against Epstein, even though it was very soft. And the former lead prosecutor for the state in that case...
Yeah, I have a direct quote from him.
Oh, go
yeah,
for it.
Yeah, he said... quote, I can emphatically state that Mr. Acosta's recollection of this matter is completely wrong, end quote. He then went on to say that Acosta had a 53-page indictment that he could have filed against Epstein at the time, but that he chose not to.
And bear in mind, you know, doing a non-prosecution agreement was a proactive step on Acosta's part. If he didn't feel that he had enough information to prosecute the case, he could have simply let the investigation continue.
Yeah.
But he chose not to do that.
Because the FBI was investigating.
Yes,
at that
he cut it off and he ended the investigation and he gave this sweetheart deal to Epstein. And
it's not like there weren't enough victims here. There were at least
dozens.
21 in the initial filing in state court, and people say there were at least 40 or more.
Yeah, and
more
have been coming out this week also.
Yeah.
And, you know, as the week went on and Acosta was facing increasing criticism for this, notably, of course, our sexual assaulter in chief.
Yes,
stood by
Epstein at the time.
Yeah, stood by Acosta. And, in fact, Acosta resigned. Trump took pains to say that was his decision, not mine. I still love the guy, blah, blah, blah. I really respect him because he's Hispanic. That's almost a direct quote. Yeah, it's just creepy all the way around.
Yes, it is. And Epstein, it came out too just yesterday, I believe, in the New York Times, that Epstein had paid a co-conspirator $100,000. And another person who may also be a co-conspirator who certainly knew of his crimes and how they were committed, he paid one of them $100,000 and the other one $250,000. So there was witness tampering involved as well.
And that's been filed in federal court now as well.
Yeah. So this is just one more cabinet member that has left the Trump White House in disgrace, bringing up again whether or not the Trump administration does any vetting of their candidates.
And bear in mind, you know, you look at past administrations, certainly in modern history, and the kind of scandals that have forced cabinet members to resign, probably the top 12 or 13 sleaziest in modern history are in the Trump administration
Trump
in the
administration
last only 2.5 years.
Yeah, now according to the Brookings Institution, Donald Trump has seen a 74% turnover of his closest White House advisors. Some of those positions have turned over multiple times, like the White House Communications Director, which was originally Michael Dubkey, then very briefly Anthony Scaramucci, then Hope Hicks.
Wasn't Sean Spicer in there too?
No, then Bill Shine, and it's now it's the Melania Trump lookalike Stephanie Grisham. No, I think you're thinking of press secretary. Yeah.
That's turned over as well.
That's turned over multiple times as well. Or as Deputy National Security Advisor, which was originally KT McFarland, then Dina Powell,
and
then Nadia Shadlow, then Mira Ricardel, and now is Charles Cooperman.
And we should mention also that there were reports, I believe, in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that Trump is looking at Fred Feitz as his replacement for Acosta as Labor Secretary. This is the guy who had to withdraw his nomination to be John Bolton's chief of staff in the National Security Council because he's too controversial and too sleazy. Now Trump wants him in his cabinet.
As labor, yeah.
Yeah, every time there's turnover in the cabinet, it seems, number one, Trump likes to have acting cabinet members so they don't have to go through Senate confirmation. But they also become sleazier and more destructive. In the case of Fred Feitz, he was a former lobbyist with Jack Abramoff for the Northern Marianas Island cluster, you know what, in the early 2000s, where the Northern Marianas was basically being operated as a sweatshop haven for foreign corporations, literally using slave labor because they were exempt from U.S. labor laws, and Feitz was lobbying to Congress to continue the exemption for those labor laws that was started under Gerald Ford.
Yeah, including granting workers in those islands the federal minimum wage.
Yeah, which it is now exempt from.
Yeah, and that's the guy he wants in labor.
Yeah.
In his labor department. Now, his cabinet, Trump's cabinet, has had more turnover than presidents who were in the White House more than twice as long as he's been there already, like George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Ronald Reagan. And Trump's only been there about 2.5 years, remember. Now, his turnover is extremely high in really key and important areas like the Department of Defense, the Department of State, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Justice, which has seen 5 different people in the role of Attorney General in 2.5 years. Sally Yates, Dana Boent, Jeff Sessions, Matthew Whitaker, and now William Barr.
3 of those, of course, were temporary.
Well, they were acting, yeah.
Acting, yes.
And, you know, when there's no continuity like that, when you're continually changing people, it really puts in place a culture of chaos and incompetence. People are continually, and ineptitude, people are continually trying to get up to speed. They don't know what they're doing. They're trying to rein in a situation that's already chaos. And we're really seeing that, I think, most visibly in the Department of Homeland Security and Border Patrol and ICE.
Yeah. And we got a bunch of revelations this week around that issue.
Yeah, where we're seeing gross human rights violations.
We're seeing not only gross human rights violations, but it's a combination of a legitimate immigration crisis in terms of what's going on in Central America and people fleeing that chaos, foreign policy incompetence on the Trump administration's part, for instance, withdrawing aid to those countries, which just makes the situation worse, as some sort of a punishment for not keeping their people fenced in. And we're seeing, a culture of racism and cruelty within ICE and the Border Patrol. That's been endemic for years, but it's certainly been encouraged under the Trump administration. And we're seeing a policy at the very top of enforced, specific, intentional cruelty toward immigrants and asylum seekers especially. And we found out a lot more about that this week. We got an Inspector General's report from the DHS this week. The Trump administration has been denying the reports of mistreatment of immigrants and saying, no, no, everything's fine.
And this is while Donald Trump refuses to go look at any of these shelters. He sent Mike Pence this week.
Yes, and I'll get to that in a second. But the IG's report specifically contradicted the Trump administration and said that in the surprise visits that they did to several border stations in El Paso and Clint, Texas, a couple of weeks ago, they found horrifying conditions. And not just because of overcrowding. It's not just a funding issue, as Trump has been claiming, but it has been an issue of specific denial of basic human needs to these prisoners. And prisoners being kept far longer than they're supposed to be at border stations where they're supposed to be turned over in 72 hours. Some of them have been there for a month and a half, 2 months, with no change of clothes, no toothbrushes, no ability to take showers, very poor nutrition.
Not even adequate food. No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a horrifying situation. Now, Pence went down to McAllen, Texas this past yesterday, I believe it was, and the pool reporter with him managed to talk his way into the visit, which was not supposed to happen, and we got video of that visit as a result. Mm-hmm. And we also got a description saying that the stench, the human stench was overwhelming. Because people hadn't been able to take showers and they're in these caged pens in the heat. You know, these people are being treated like animals or worse, and that's
worse
very
than
intentional.
You would, yeah, worse than you would treat animals, because animals you would at least feed them and provide them with water and some basic cleanliness in order to keep disease from spreading among your animal population.
Yeah, and not in that place where they can actually lay down.
Yeah, they're not even being treated as well as we treat farm animals.
Yeah. Let alone, you know, pets. It's just disgusting, honestly. Mm-hmm. We saw in over, I think, 800 cities across the country, or 800 locations, protest yesterday in support of immigrant rights, including several here in the Seattle area. And there's one going on now down at the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. We'll talk about that at the end of the show. But it's well worth raising hell about, because this is something that the United States is being watched by the rest of the world. They're watching what we're doing, and they're horrified.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting, you know, the bill that was passed to the emergency funding bill that Donald Trump asked for to provide more money for housing immigrants in detention and supposedly to alleviate some of these problems. That emergency bill in the House, the Democrats had attached a whole bunch of restrictions to how the money would be spent, to specify that it not be used in further ICE raids, that it not be used to build new detention facilities.
Or to be diverted to Trump's wall.
Yeah, or be diverted to building the border wall, but to only provide humanitarian assistance to people who are in immigration detention currently. And even that was controversial. There were four House reps who didn't vote for that bill, the four freshman women led by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who said that, you know, any funding for these violations of human rights, this whole Trump detain and not give people a hearing date and release them is wrong. Yeah. And yet, you know, the rest of the Democrats in the House voted for that bill. But then when the Senate passed a similar bill that didn't include any of those restrictions on the funding.
The Republicans stripped them out.
Yeah.
Under McConnell.
It split the Democrats in the House. And the conservative Democrats voted with the Republicans to pass the Senate version. It even split the House leadership, with Nancy Pelosi and some of her leadership voting for that Senate bill that now allows the Trump administration to spend the money however it pleases. That's a scandal as well.
It is. And, you know, Trump also this past weekend has been threatening ICE raids starting tomorrow. It was 10. Now it's 9 because they actually noticed that New Orleans might not be the best place to do ICE raids today.
Yes.
A number of mayors in those cities, particularly Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York, have been pledging non-cooperation with ICE, including not letting local police share databases, that sort of thing. and there have been a lot of protests specifically against those potential raids as well. So we'll see whether those raids actually happen. They've been threatened numerous times before over the past month or two. This is all part of Trump's appealing to his base and trying to get reelected. And it's really quite disgusting that he thinks that treating human beings like this will rebound to his political advantage.
Yeah, and it also has the effect of terrorizing immigrant populations inside the United States. People
and that's
who are
point.
Not in detention yet, they go to ground. Their kids don't go to school. They don't turn up at work. They don't go to doctor's appointments. They don't go to the grocery store.
They don't report crimes.
Yeah, they don't report crimes against them. It is horrific.
Well, and that relates to an article that came out this week regarding the ICE going through the DMV records here in King County.
In King County, yeah.
And, you know, this is supposedly a sanctuary city and a sanctuary county. And
King County had passed that. The King County Council had passed that law as a sanctuary county. Right. And
nobody bothered to train the
Nobody
actual
bothered
staff.
To take aside the people in the King County Sheriff's Office and train them on what that meant. And so they continued to allow ICE to access those driver's license records and those records too, which of course includes your photo as well as your address and your name and your date of birth and everything, in order to round people up and detain them and deport them.
So some of these officials, they make these stances, but they don't do any of the follow-through. So, I mean, when we've got these...
I think that should be a direct question for Dow Constantine, because really he's the chief executive of the county.
The buck stops with him.
And Mitzi Johannick, who's the sheriff of the police department, they both need to answer for that.
Yep. And, you know, when we're speaking of terrorizing immigrant communities, we saw that this week when Trump finally caved on the citizenship question on next year's census, mm-hmm. where he said, oh, but by the way, we'll just collect all the same information through other means. This again, is an attempt to terrorize immigrant communities, even people who are here legally, even whole families who are here legally, but don't want to risk being deported. We saw an example of this week where a guy was finally released after 13 months in ICE detention.
13 months, over a year.
Yeah. For a Spanish language reporter who'd worked at several radio stations and had started a Spanish language news website in Memphis. He was covering a protest, was scooped up by the local police who then dropped the charges when they realized that he was actually wearing a press pass. But he was handed over to ICE, and it took him 13 months to get out of detention.
Yeah, legal resident.
And that was, again, mentioned by the Trump administration with the raids that are supposedly occurring tomorrow, that they are expecting, if you're nearby when they're doing the raids, that there could be collateral people that get swept up in those. And,
no biggie.
So, yeah, no
As long biggie. As they're brown skin, we're happy to get rid of them.
Yeah. Now, just want to say that if you witness one of those raids, you are perfectly free to film. You need to stay on public property when you do so, unless you are invited by the owner of the property onto their property or in their house to film.
And if you are subject to one of those raids, you are under you need not let anybody into your property or your rental unit or your home unless they have a warrant. Mm-hmm. You don't have to answer.
Signed by a judge and not an ICE representative.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't have to let them in the door. You don't have to answer their questions. And you can insist on having a lawyer present as well. And there are plenty of local nonprofits who are offering legal assistance at this point.
For that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So know your rights. And the ACLU and a number of immigrant groups have very good summaries of your rights on the internet. So it's well worth looking up.
So now Trump backing down on the citizenship question. Last week, the Department of Justice lawyers were set to accept the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling and remove the citizenship question from the 2020 census. And in fact, they did that, and the census was starting to be printed. And then over the weekend, Donald Trump tweeted a whole bunch of garbage about how the fight wasn't over yet. And then he tried to have all of those DOJ lawyers removed and replaced by new lawyers on that case. But a New York federal court judge, Jesse Furman, refused this week to let Donald Trump replace his entire team of lawyers until they could give a good, sound reason for why they were being replaced, and they could show that it wouldn't impact their case. the president's whim, in other words, is not good enough explanation in a legal court of law for replacing his entire the entire team working on a federal case. Given that the DOJ couldn't come up with a good sound reason for the citizenship question in the first place, it was pretty clear that there was no good reason that could be given to explain for replacing the entire legal team on the case. In fact, it appears that all of those lawyers wanted to resign themselves out of ethical concerns and the recognition that the case itself could not be won in court, especially since Donald Trump has now said multiple times in public that the real reason for adding the citizenship question is to discourage Latino folks from filling out the form and thereby help Republicans in drawing electoral districts, which is the opposition's argument for not including the question on the census in the first place.
Yes, and there's documentation at this point that that was the original intent of
yes.
the whole project.
Yes, indeed.
And we had another remarkable court hearing yesterday, an appeals court in D.C. A panel was hearing the Trump administration's appeal of a lower court having ruled against them in the House of Representatives' attempt to subpoena the accounting firm for Trump's taxes and his financial records. The lower court ruled resoundingly against the Trump administration. The oral arguments were heard yesterday. They were actually made available, the audio of them. And you can hear one of the appeals judges actually laughing at the argument of the Trump administration lawyer, actually his personal lawyer for Donald Trump, who is arguing that the House of Representatives had no constitutional oversight ability over the president, none whatsoever. And so the appellate judge was asking, so let's imagine that you had the most corrupt imaginable president. Is there any law that the Congress could pass to rein that president in or to deal with that issue? And the Trump lawyer was saying, well, no, it sounds extreme, but no.
And the answer is, it is extreme. No.
Yeah. And also Article 1, Section 2, I believe, of the Constitution very clearly spells out Congress's oversight ability
yes.
over the president.
Uh-huh.
So that argument is going nowhere yeah. in federal court.
So in short, it's a completely thankless job being a lawyer for
yeah.
the Department of Justice these days.
And that lawsuit is likely, I think the Trump folks are hoping to appeal it to the Supreme Court, and that the unitary theory of executive power will have more sympathy, a more sympathetic hearing at the Supreme Court, but there is no precedent for it. There is no reading of the Constitution, really, that allows it in the real world, as opposed to the fantasy world of the Trump administration, where the person yeah. in chief would very much like to be a dictator.
Yeah, and you know, a similar issue, too, was in Donald Trump's consideration of maybe issuing an executive order to include the citizenship question on the census. But, you know, the census is overseen by Congress. It is firmly in their bailiwick to determine how the census is conducted and what questions are allowed on it, not the president. So his executive order that he was considering issuing would have been meaningless and would have had no legal effect. And of course, he would have had to go to court in order to try to enforce it again. As you know, Job was saying, his lawyers probably would have been laughed out of court. So clearly, I think somebody with some common sense spoke to him about, well, you can consider an executive order, but...
Yeah, and it also has mm-hmm. a second problem, which is that is the one thing that the Constitution actually specifies as a firm deadline. It specifies
yes.
when you have to have the census ready to go to
and
count.
And the census and is already being printed.
Yes,
so it's a done deal.
That's April 1st, 2020.
Citizenship
It's an every 10 years thing, April 1st, and you have to have it printed for 330 million people. You know, the printing had already started as of July 1st. There was no leeway there.
Okay.
All right.
But Constitution be damned.
Yeah.
just 5 minutes left. Job, did you want to talk about the fine weather?
Yeah, we're watching Louisiana suffer again through something that's very specific to climate change, the flooding threat from now tropical storm again, Barry. And you have to understand that this is the same story that produced the torrential rains in the Midwest this past spring, that the Mississippi is already at flood stage in Louisiana now and its various tributaries. because of the torrential rains in places like Iowa, Oklahoma, Indiana, all that huge basin of the Mississippi is draining through Florida, and that's what the levees are already trying to hold
Louisiana.
Back. And so you put 25 inches of rain on top of that from a very slow-moving tropical storm, and you know you're going to get chaos. We've seen levees fail already in Plaquemines Parish, southeast of New Orleans. So far, New Orleans has seen spot flooding, but it's relatively okay. Since Katrina, they have added a couple of feet to the levees system in most areas
but
around there.
They were already, the Mississippi was already within 20 inches of topping those levees. So adding 24 to 25 inches of rain on top of that could mean a disaster again.
And,
in New Orleans.
And again, even if New Orleans escapes escapes issues, there's a vast area of rural and populated Louisiana that is at risk, and all of that is low-lying and flat and protected by levees that are likely to spill over.
Just to remind folks the reason why we're seeing these kinds of massive rains, when ocean water's warm, a lot of that, there's typically a lot more water, a lot more moisture that gets pulled up into these big storms than there used to be. So it isn't always the wind speed anymore that is the problem. Those, hurricane.
Yeah, we saw this
level four, level five. Those are high wind speeds. It's not necessarily the wind speed that is the issue now. It's how quickly the storm moves, and in this case, Barry is a slow moving storm, and how much moisture it carries.
Yeah,
how much rain it's going to.
We saw this with Harvey 2 years ago, and 60 inches of rain in Houston, which flooded vast sections of Houston.
Yeah,
because it was a very slow moving tropical system. Yeah. That dumped torrential rains
not
in southeast
high,
Texas.
Not high wind speeds, just a slow-moving storm with a ton of water.
Yeah, and this is going to be an ongoing issue with climate change. It's just going to get worse.
And we're seeing, with the current administration, that when disasters happen, it just appears to be no movement towards sending any relief to any of these.
That's the incompetence.
Yeah. And I remember when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and how that was a scandal for the Bush administration to try recover from. Yeah.
That was really the major turning point for the Bush administration, because they had just been reelected the previous year. And Bush was really kind of unable to do anything for his second term because of that, because the public perception became that the administration was simply incompetent, which it was.
Yeah. So I'm not eager to see Donald Trump. I'm not eager to see Donald Trump bungle this disaster the way he bungled Puerto Rico's.
Yeah, well, hurricane. You know, Louisiana is separated by a vast ocean of floodwater.
No.
It will be soon.
Anyway.
All right. Events.
Going on right now through about 4:30 this afternoon, Lights on Detained People, which is a continuation of the Lights for Liberty protest that we saw yesterday for immigrant rights across the country. This is a noisemaker protest, so the people inside detention can hear that there are people supporting them on the outside. This is outside the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma, so if you're down that part of the greater Seattle area, please do stop by and help out with the noisemaking and the support for detained people.
You might want to check with the organizations that are doing that before heading down, just because I had seen online this morning that there had been a shooting right outside that facility, and it was unclear during the morning what the situation was for being able to get close enough to
check that online then. Northwest Detention Center is at 1623 East J Street in Tacoma. So if you are familiar with it, or if you're down that way, check online to make sure it's still happening, and if it is, head down there.
Okay, and then also today is Community Alliance for Global Justice's 13th Annual Benefit Dinner. This year's speaker is Doria Robinson, the Executive Director of Urban Tilth. She'll be talking about agroecology and its role in addressing climate change. That's from 5 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. at St. Demetrios Greek Orthodox Church at 2100 Boyer Avenue East.
And it's a fine organization to support.
Yes. And then tomorrow is Unite Against the Alt-Right and Hate Crimes in Seattle. That's a rally and protest to protest the emergence of alt-right and violent racist groups like the Proud Boys. That's from 3:30 to 6:30 outside City Hall at 5th and James Street downtown. On Monday is the No Tech for ICE rally to deliver 200,000 signatures on a petition to Amazon calling for them to stop supporting Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's hosted by La Resistencia and Puget Sound Sage. That's from noon to 1 p.m. on Monday at Amazon headquarters at 6th and Lenora near the Spheres. And then on Thursday is Segregated by Design, film screening and discussion about the history of how federal, state, and local governments intentionally segregated U.S. cities. That's hosted by Capitol Hill Renter Initiative from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at 12th Avenue Arts at 1620 12th Avenue in the Pike Pine Room. And then next Friday is the 24-hour live marathon reading of the full Robert Mueller report, including footnotes and redactions. That starts at 8 p.m. on Friday and runs until 8 p.m. on Saturday at Town Hall.
And a week from Wednesday, Mueller will be testifying to the House Intelligence and Judicial Committees.
At 7th and Seneca. And you can walk in and listen to parts of it, or you can listen to the whole thing if you want to. Check that out.
Print it out. Yep. Follow along in the...
Yeah. The primary ballots will be mailed on Wednesday. Should be in your hands by the end of the week. And again, check for our recommendations.
If you don't get your ballot, because the state is going through a new system for elections now, if you don't get your ballot, make sure you follow up, call, or go online and let them know you didn't receive your ballot because there may be some issues with it.
And
mailing them out.
And King County Elections would be the one in King County to administer that.
To go to.
Mm-hmm. All right.